ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Christmas Eve, the 24th of December. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Sweeping changes to gun and protest laws have passed the New South Wales Parliament during the early hours this morning. The changes are in response to last week's Bondi Beach terror attack. But how long they'll last is uncertain, as critics are threatening a constitutional challenge next month. And experts have differing views on their likelihood of success and on the merits of the new legislation, as Annie Guest reports.
As grief and horror over the Bondi attack mix with community anger and heated political division, the man who presided over Australia's biggest terrorism trials, Anthony Whealy KC, has this warning.
We have to be careful to try and restore the balance of goodwill in our society. And we don't do that by divisive and hateful actions, because hate breeds hate and violence breeds violence.
Anthony Whealy questions how new anti-protest and hate speech legislation put forward by the New South Wales Premier could prevent so-called lone wolf attacks. But activist groups argue restricting protests could limit free speech, so they're planning a high court challenge. Anthony Whealy thinks it may succeed. The KC also says banning protests up to 3 months after a terrorist attack could have unintended consequences.
If this law were enforced now and the Jewish community want to protest themselves about what they saw as, say, for example, inadequate policing at the Hanukkah event, I'm not saying that there was inadequate policing, but let's assume that they wanted to have such a protest, they wouldn't be able to.
While he supports banning terrorist flags and symbols, Anthony Whealy says invoking violence or reprehensible anti-Jewish chants should be dealt with under existing law, not new ones. As a man who headed the Counter-Terrorism Law Committee for the Council of Australian Governments, Anthony Whealy also questions banning chants like "From the River to the Sea, Palestine should be free."
Does that necessarily mean that they want to see the state of Israel eradicated by uttering that phrase? I mean, if that's what it means, then really it should be criminalised. But if it doesn't mean that, and to many people it doesn't, it just means Palestinians should be free within the lands of Palestine and Israel, for that matter, then it's not hateful.
Professor Ron Levy is an expert in constitutional law at ANU, and he's also Jewish. He thinks a high court challenge might not succeed.
You know, I wouldn't expect that the court is going to be very gung-ho about striking it down. I think that, you know, the court, like anyone else, is going to be aware of the context that there has been, you know, hate speech and, you know, rise in hateful expressions, and that, you know, perhaps it's actually reasonable for a government to try to rein that in. So, you know, the court will be aware of that context and might actually be swayed by that.
Professor Levy points out that there are limitations on the legislation's ability to restrict protests after terrorism, and he says it's too early to ascertain which phrases or chants could be outlawed.
So you can't really in advance, you know, cover out all of the different scenarios that might actually be hateful speech. I think that's for the sort of experts to hash out in a particular case-by-case basis. Then we can trust, hopefully, that process will, you know, reach the right answers. But, you know, to say that we shouldn't even try is, I think, problematic.
But Professor Levy also points out the laws have been hastily drafted.
So it's reactive. It's only been about 9 days, you know, since the terror attack. So that really the whole question is going to be, is this law proportionate? Is it achieving its aims? Those aims are safety, you know, dignity, protecting people against harassment.
Professor Ron Levy from the Australian National University, ending Any Guest's report. Travel entitlements for federal politicians' families will be tightened. The Prime Minister's announced they'll be less generous. It follows intense scrutiny on the travel and taxpayer-funded expenses of the Sport and Communications Minister Annika Wells and other MPs and senators in federal parliament. Political reporter Tom Crowley joined me earlier from Melbourne. Tom, what's changing?
So, Sabra, a series of rules changing after, of course, a discussion that went on for quite a while in early December about politicians and their spending. The big focus of all of that was on family reunion travel, the essentially effectively unlimited budgets that politicians had to fly their partners around the country to meet them and to Canberra. There were technically some limits on the number of flights that they could use, but in practice we saw some MPs spending 5-6 figure sums to fly their families around in business class, and that in particular the Prime Minister has recommended will change. All of these changes will need to be ticked off by the Parliament's Privileges Committee. But it seems that that's essentially a fait accompli. Now families will only be able to travel in economy class and only to Canberra. It's a crackdown that the Prime Minister says will spare young children, or at least have some different rules for parents of young children, because he says he wants the Parliament to remain a family-friendly place. But economy flights only, and flights only to Canberra now for politicians' family members. There are also some new rules about when politicians can claim or bill taxpayers to travel to events. The events will now have to relate to either their ministerial portfolios or else to their parliamentary responsibilities. Quite a bit of scrutiny earlier in December over politicians billing taxpayers to travel to sporting events. If you're the sports minister, as Annika Wells is, of course, that will still be fine. But if that's not in your portfolio, even if you might be meeting in general with some stakeholders while you attend a sports match or something like that, you'll no longer be able to bill taxpayers for that. So they're the rules that are changing in the main for politicians. A recognition, I think, from the government after a period of sustained scrutiny, not just on Annika Wells, but a lot of people across the Parliament, that the rules, which had been set for several years without changing, had fallen foul of public opinion, the pub test that got a good run in that week, and that there was a need to change.
You know, you say that it's a done deal. The opposition had offered bipartisanship on the changes. Does that stand?
Yeah, so the opposition did say yesterday that this was an admission from the Prime Minister that the rules were out of step and that what his ministers had been claiming on travel wasn't appropriate. But despite saying that, they did give an indication that while they would have to look at the details closely, and we haven't seen exactly what the Prime Minister has recommended to the Privileges Committee, that they thought in general the tenor of the changes looked positive. So I think that bodes well for the prospect of bipartisanship on this.
Tom, on a different subject matter, back to the Bondi terrorist attacks, the Prime Minister has invited Israel's President Isaac Herzog to visit Australia as soon as possible.
That's right. The pair spoke yesterday over the phone. It's the first official contact at leader level, or certainly from the Prime Minister, that we've been made aware of, at least, since the Bondi terror attack. And the pair discussed the attack with Isaac Herzog, the President, urging further action to be taken on cracking down on anti-Semitism in Australia. Of course, the Netanyahu government in Israel's system, separate somewhat from the President, but many frontbenchers from that government have been deeply critical of the Australian government. Isaac Herzog, in general, has been slightly more moderate in his criticism. So the pair speaking there, and the invitation for an official visit will be issued from the Governor-General at the recommendation of the Australian government. No timing yet on a visit, but as soon as possible were the words that were used in the Prime Minister's readout of the call shared on social media. So that visit could happen, of course, as early as next year.
Political reporter Tom Crowley there, and the Executive Council of Australian Juries, Alex Rivchin, says the invitation's a welcome decision.
The relationship has had some severe ruptures and it's been in a state of decline, which has really upset the community, because Australia and Israel have been historic allies. As Jewish Australians, we want to see a strong relationship between the two countries. But sometimes it takes a catastrophe, a tragedy, to bring a sense of perspective and clarity and bring two feuding partners together, particularly having spent a lot of time in the last few days in the hospital with the families of those who are still in a very bad state, many of whom are in ICU. I know they'll be buoyed by this, and to see the president face to face, I think, will be a huge morale boost for them. So that's really important.
Artificial intelligence will change the way we fight fires. Parts of New South Wales are facing an increased fire risk this summer. And this season, a multi-million dollar network of AI fire spotting cameras is being rolled out across the state and already proving their worth. The use follows a recommendation by an inquiry into the Black Summer fires of 2019 and 2020. Emily Doak prepared this report.
Tune it for Kendall. Wind direction southwest.
In summer, Catherine Clark spends up to 10 hours a day in a high tower overlooking softwood plantations in southern New South Wales. As a fire spotter, she's not here for the panoramic views, but to watch for smoke.
Because even if it's small, if they believe it's smoke, they need to act on that. Machinery can do a spark when they're doing harvest time. Hay can self-combust.
Catherine Clark can't be on lookout all the time, but new cameras are. They scan the landscape and, using artificial intelligence, track changes in the images to detect smoke columns before alerting fire authorities. More than 36 of them now operate in southern New South Wales in national parks, forests and farmland. The government and private investment have put in $9 million to install and run these cameras over 5 years. Carly Porteous is from the Softwoods Working Group. She says this season, having cameras in more locations beyond traditional towers has helped to prevent fires taking hold.
Notifications of fires within minutes of a puff of smoke being detected, but certainly what the cameras are doing, finding those black spots where towers don't currently exist.
The Black Summer bushfires of 2019-2020 destroyed 45,000 hectares of planned plantations in the Riverina Highlands in southern New South Wales. More than 80% has been replanted. But Roger Davies from the Forestry Corporation of New South Wales says it'll take decades for the industry to recover.
Time is everything when you're growing a forest and getting those products to market. We've really needed to lift our game in terms of how can we detect, prevent, extinguish any fires that are in the landscape.
Technology is playing a key role in that defence. Since Black Summer, the New South Wales Rural Fire Service has also introduced AI fire analysis software, mobile data terminals in vehicles, and automatic weather stations. Dr. Mahesh Prakash researches disaster management and climate change risk with CSIRO. He says as Australia adapts to global warming, new technologies like the AI cameras mean better decisions can be made around resourcing.
Detection technologies are becoming critical. You can get to the fire before it becomes uncontrollable. You can also decide which ones to fight first. Like, you know, the ones that are much closer to human settlement. Fire seasons are kind of occurring much earlier than they used to. So it definitely helps with, you know, managing your limited resources.
CSIRO's Dr. Mahesh Prakash ending Emily Doak's report. Palestinians in the West Bank city of Bethlehem are hoping the Christmas spirit has returned to their city after two long years of hardship fueled by the war in Gaza and an Israeli crackdown on the West Bank. But even as local authorities try to convince tourists and pilgrims to return, restrictions on travelling to the place where Jesus was born remain in place. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
Ronny Tabash's face is etched with pride as he shows us the intricate wooden carvings he sells.
Look at this one. This is from the root of the tree, olive tree, made by families in Bethlehem.
Ronny is the third generation from his family to run their souvenir shop across the road from the Church of the Nativity in the heart of Bethlehem.
My grandfather opened this store in 1927, and after 2 years, we will be here 100 years.
The war in Gaza has cast a long shadow over the West Bank, putting immense pressure on businesses such as Ronnie's.
Even my father, he always tell me, Ronnie, go open the shop. It's not just for the business, it's for our hope, because we need this place, our history place, to be always open.
Bethlehem is a city which doesn't just thrive on tourism and pilgrims travelling to the site where Christians believe Jesus was born. Its very survival is reliant on them. Bethlehem's mayor is Maha Nicola Kanawati.
We had a loss of approximately $1.8 million a day in the industry of tourism. The unemployment rate jumped from 14 to 65%. Poverty touched 60%. 4,000 people left.
And that's why this year the mayor determined things will be different. The traditional Christmas celebrations have returned, including the recent lighting of the massive Christmas tree, which towers over Manger Square below.
After 2 years of silence, we decided to reignite Christmas, to reignite the spirit that everybody needs here in town.
It's as much a message to the local community as it is to the world.
Christmas in Bethlehem is special.
Samir Kumsia is a local historian and the director of Nativity TV, which broadcasts church services, including Midnight Mass, to the world.
People say, no, there is a war in Gaza. We cannot celebrate. It is, although personally I am against this. I want a Christian festival. It should go on as usual, always.
He hopes numbers will be up compared to the last few years, but knows the conflict nearby still looms large.
Now, this year was exceptional because with the ceasefire of war, although it is not total ceasefire because Netanyahu is continuing, people, yani church leaders and the political leaders said, okay, we can go ahead with this and we hope that it ends peacefully.
It's still not entirely straightforward to get to Bethlehem, less than 10 kilometres away from Jerusalem's old city. But on the other side of the wall Israel built, cutting off the West Bank from the Holy City. Mayor Kanawati says checkpoints open and close with no notice.
Yeah, now all of these hardships are unfortunately normal for the Palestinians. Bethlehem is international and Bethlehem is the capital of the Christian world. So you, if you're a Christian, you have a piece of Bethlehem.
This is Matthew Doran in Bethlehem, reporting for AM.
And now some news from me. It's time to turn off the early morning alarm. Today's program is my last hosting AM. I'm taking a long break over summer and I'll be back next year in a different role. So as I prepare to turn off the mic, colleague Nick Grimm has crafted a retrospective of my time in the studio. Anthony Albanese, welcome to AM.
Thanks for having me on the program, Sabra.
Joining us now is the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Sabra.
Joining us now is the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull.
Good morning and happy 50th birthday.
Thank you.
For AM.
When Sabra Lane signed on as AM host in 2017, the program had just reached its first half century on air. Now she hangs up the AM headphones, just a year or so shy of its 60th anniversary.
It seems hard to believe that it's been almost a decade that Sabra has been that wonderfully reassuring voice, bringing AM listeners the latest in international and domestic news.
That's former AM executive producer Kim Landers, who worked closely with Sabra for much of her time on the program.
9 years, that's a lot of pre-dawn starts, made possible, of course, by plenty of adrenaline and a steady supply of caffeine.
I like it early in the morning. It's black and strong, it's piping hot first.
Prime Minister, as Australians tune out of politics and take a summer break, will you use the opportunity to find your mojo?
Well, we'll continue to examine ways.
You've just run through that. Prime Minister, how will you regain your mojo?
What we're doing is continuing to roll out our plan to turn around Australia's economy that we've done under very difficult circumstances.
Do you need, sorry to interrupt, do you need fresh faces and fresh ideas?
As you know, the costings I've already released this morning on their retirees
and
tax.
We'll have plenty of time between now and the next election to discuss that.
We'll talk about it now if you don't mind.
No, actually, I do mind because I've got questions for you and you're the government.
Kim Landers again.
Sabra is smart, she's persistent, she can be slightly annoying for her interviewees, but she's always asking questions that people want answered.
Do you try and raise concerns with the Labor Party campaign during the election that things weren't okay?
Sabra, you know me, I don't talk about internal matters.
In terms of policy, I mean, we've got...
I was just going to say, though, getting back to that criticism that I put to you earlier, that the campaign is the worst in the Liberals' history and it couldn't have gone worse. Do you disagree with that?
Of course I do. I mean, that's, insider talk from left-wing journalists. I'm not worried about that.
I can assure you it hasn't come from left-wing journalists. It's come from within your party.
Yeah, well, all I'm worried about is how we can help families. And
you could sense a tone of disapproval in her voice, the persistent follow-up questions.
How irritating is that?
I'm not going to comment on what he has said, except to say that when I spoke, well, no, because the leader of the Nationals is actually David.
All up, an influence on AM, Kim Landers believes, won't be easily replicated.
So there will be massive shoes to fill, but the AM, the program, it's got a long history, it's got a terrific history, and so I'm sure there will be somebody who will step into those shoes and continue the great legacy of AM.
AM's former executive producer Kim Landers there, Nick Grimm with that report. Thank you, Nick, and thank you to all my ABC colleagues and to you, dear listener. Thank you. It's been an absolute privilege. That's AM for today. Thank you for your company. Merry Christmas. I'm Sabra Lane.